Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt. Thanks for joining me here. This is episode number 419, and in a few moments, I'll be sharing with you an interview that I think is very important, and I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with Lisa Diehl and Fernando Murillo, who both work with the Humane Prison Hospice Project, and we'll be talking all about prison hospice in today's conversation. This is very important because just last month, a study came out showing that about one-third of our incarcerated population now is over the age of 55, and that age group is considered geriatric in the prison population because those people have a much shorter longevity than the rest of the population. So age 55 and above is when the prison population begins experiencing the effects of aging and chronic illness and needing extra care. So anyway, this is a great conversation and very important. Before we get to the interview, though, just a couple of announcements. I've been talking lately about my new campaign, $10 for 10 years, which is to help me celebrate the 10th anniversary of End of Life University. And I am asking for donations of just $10 to commemorate the 10th anniversary and to also help me get a new laptop, which I really need because I'm starting to have a lot of problems with my laptop, which they tell me is the motherboard starting to malfunction. I don't understand very much about it. All I know is that I'm going to need a new laptop in the near future. So I'm saving up donations to be able to purchase a laptop to make sure I can keep this show on the air. There is a button on the show notes page at eolupodcast.com that says $10 for 10 years, and you can just make a $10 donation through PayPal if you're interested. You can also go to eoluniversity.com/support, and there you'll find three other ways of making a contribution to help me keep the podcast going. And I want to thank everyone who's been stepping up over the last couple of weeks on my new Patreon supporters, Kathy Duke, Lori Kurz, and Kelly Oberle. Thank you so much for joining my team on Patreon. And I just came out with a brand new end of the month update on End of Life News. And I curate that and create a recording about the latest articles in the news around end of life issues for my Patreon supporters. So all of you should have received that in the last week. And also I want to thank supporters on PayPal on the $10 for 10 years program: Lori McLeod, Haley London, Brittany Ellis, Lorraine Broom, Samnang Hung, and Mary Dupuy. Thank you all so very much. I can't even begin to tell you how much I appreciate your support. It means everything to me. And also, I wanted to mention, last week was a self-care week, and I had cataract surgery as part of my self-care, and I just wanted to mention it was a huge success. Everything went really well, and I am so very, very grateful to have my eyesight once again. And I really didn't realize how much stress it was causing for me and what a toll it was taking on me to have this cataract over the last year, to not be able to see very clearly. And I am so thrilled and so very happy to have had this surgery done. So thanks for supporting me through a self-care week, because literally it changes everything when we take time out and do things that we need to keep ourselves healthy and to just remember to love ourselves. So again, thank you for all the emotional support I've received and people writing in to say, enjoy self-care week. I'm glad you're doing it, and I need to do it too. So I'm very grateful. If you have a cataract, get surgery. Don't hesitate. It changes everything. So now we're going to move on with my interview with Lisa Diehl and Fernando Murillo. And stay tuned afterwards. I'll come back with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome two guests to the podcast, Lisa Diehl and Fernando Murillo. They both work with the Humane Prison Hospice Project. Lisa began her nursing career as a community health nurse caring for AIDS patients in Boston during the late 1980s. She is currently the executive director of the Humane Prison Hospice Project, where she focuses on strategic planning, fundraising, program development, and administration, and supporting the incredible Humane team as they seek to ensure that those dying in prison receive compassionate end-of-life care. Fernando is the program manager for the Palliative Care Initiative at the Humane Prison Hospice Project, where he trains incarcerated people to provide palliative and hospice care for their aging and dying peers. During Fernando's 24 years of incarceration, he committed himself to improving the overall quality of life in the correctional setting for everyone present, staff and incarcerated people alike. And we'll get to hear a lot more of Lisa and Fernando's stories, but you can learn more at the website humaneprisonhospiceproject.org. And I just want to say, as I welcome you, Lisa and Fernando, that Edgar Behrens, who created the documentary film Prison Terminal, was one of the very first people I interviewed for End of Life University back in 2014 when his documentary had been nominated for an Oscar. And I was so moved and touched by his film, and that's where I really learned about prison hospice in the first place. So I've been passionate about this cause myself ever since seeing that film. And when I learned I could have a chance to interview the two of you, I just got so excited, and I'm thrilled that we can have this conversation and then share it with the audience. So thank you both for being here and welcome.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say, Karen, as we get started, that I'm thrilled that you learned about this work from Edgar and his film. Edgar is currently on the Humane team, and we still use Prison Terminal to really educate folks about the needs of aging and dying prisoners. So it's great to know that's the origins of your interest in this work.
Things come full circle sometimes. Well, to get started, I thought maybe, Lisa, you could just briefly tell our audience what the Humane Prison Hospice Project is and what you do, and then a little bit about your story and how you got involved with the project.
Yeah, I would love to share that. So the Humane Prison Hospice Project is a California-based organization, a very small organization, and our mission is really to help transform the way incarcerated people die through education, advocacy, and most importantly, training and supporting fellow incarcerated peers to be end-of-life caregivers and grief companions behind bars. And we got involved, I got involved with Humane when I was chief clinical officer at Mission Hospice and Home Care in San Mateo, California. And at the time, the Humane team, which existed of the three co-founders, were looking to go into San Quentin to teach a group of peer caregivers there about providing end-of-life care. This is a peer caregiver group that was called Brothers Keepers, and they were really providing peer support around crisis intervention and suicide prevention in San Quentin. And they were very interested in getting training about providing end-of-life care to their peers, as they were watching many of their peers age and die, and also just cope with grief in their own lives, maybe from losses they experienced in their families and the community who they couldn't be with. So they were looking for a community-based hospice to kind of partner with them around the curriculum to be able to bring into San Quentin. There was no prison hospice at San Quentin. There still isn't, but work is moving forward in that area there. And so we really came in doing this work in San Quentin. So it was a great start. We were in San Quentin until the pandemic, and are going to kind of be going back in to teach this. It's now called the Lightkeepers Program, to help coordinate that program. And since then, our work has become more kind of ingrained and focused on providing really a curriculum around end-of-life care and palliative care training. And that's what we're working on now and have been starting to implement in the California prisons.
Mm. It's really wonderful to hear. I was just thrilled when I realized that there was such a project in existence, because I was always curious after seeing Edgar's film, if it had spread anywhere, if were any other prisons creating hospices and involved in this movement. So I'm happy to learn about it. And Fernando, I'd love to hear more of your story and the whole story, or whatever you'd like to tell us about how you ended up being trained yourself in palliative care.
Oh, thanks for asking the question. This is very interesting that I have the platform or opportunity to even answer it. So I received a life sentence at the age of 16, 41 years for life approximately. And on my incarceration journey, after like 19 years, approximately 19 years, I ended up in a prison called California Medical Facility. I was 35 years old at the time. It was super hot when I arrived. It was like July. It was like 100+ degrees. And it was like a new start for me. And what I mean by that is, like, most California prisons that I've been to, you know, they weren't the most, like places that you can go to and program and prepare for reentry, you know, as a successful citizen in the community. They just weren't designed, you know, for that to happen. Well, I ended up at California Medical Facility, and they had a lot of opportunities for incarcerated folks, you know, to get in rehabilitation programming, educational programming. And I had no idea that there was an end-of-life palliative care unit, a hospice unit in California Medical Facility. I actually learned about it by accident. You know, I became what is called a healthcare facility maintenance worker. And after all of my extensive training that I received and my orientations, I was taken down to the hospice for hands-on training to perform my duties. And I was blown away by what I see. I had no idea that there was a space of normalization in which people received compassionate end-of-life care. I had no idea that there was a space for people to pass away, period, you know, in a dignified way anywhere in the prison system. And so I didn't say anything, or, you know, I didn't say much vocally, but I ended up making friends with a good a person that worked in there. His name is Kendrick Flowers. And after like interacting with him and meeting with him day to day, just doing my job, he said, "Hey man, you do great in here. You would perform well. You're kind, you're empathetic. You know, you obviously relate to the patients well." And I was like, "Thank you. I appreciate it. But, that's an emphatic no for me. I cannot do it." And I didn't say no and reject his offer, you know, to like begin training or talk to the chaplain about a possible position of working in there. I said no because I didn't think I was capable of, you know, the investment that it requires being in that position. You know, it's a round the clock job. You know, it's definitely a job or a position in which, you know, you invest in patients and, you know, their individuality and their life journey until they're no longer alive. And I didn't think I was capable of fully committing to that, you know? So I said no. I didn't just say no the first time. I said no two more times. And I finally agreed in September 2015. And the rest is history. And I can literally tell you from a literal standpoint, I answered call lights to the day I left prison in November 2020. It didn't stop. You know, and what I mean by that is, like, I tell people all the time what it's like working in the hospice and in CMF Vacaville, is that I looked at the clock one day in September 15, and I looked up again, and it was 2020. You know, it's just that place just consumes every ounce of your existence because people require your time, your energy, your love, your compassion, your patience, you know, your community investment. So I ended up working there for almost 6 years. It was approximately five. And that's how I got involved with there. And it totally changed my perspective on my existence as a human being, how that relates to the community, you know, as a whole. It helped me to reflect my place in the world. And it helped me to take all the life lessons that I've learned in that environment outside of there and apply it to the greater gathering, as my friend Salika Jawad says. So That's how I get involved with working in end-of-life palliative care, receiving training from Chaplain Keith. Every palliative care worker, as of, you know, right now, from his, you know, training, you know, his training modules or training curriculum, it requires 82 hours of training. That's both from an academic standpoint and video watching and hands-on training. So it's a combination of three things that people in the hospice with get involved with and have to do before beginning. So, but now we have an entire initiative, a new one, in which we're training people in a whole different way. And it's wonderful to start this pilot amongst the residents that live at California Medical Facility, the way it's been received, the way that our facilitators have been deploying it, the development from one of our wonderful staff members, Susan Barber, and the rest of the team has just been remarkable. So I know I said a lot and I started at the beginning, made a full circle, but I can fill in some gaps as we talk. So,
I can only imagine how powerful it is when you're in a setting where it seems to me, this just comes from my limited understanding, but where there's sometimes a lack of caring shown to individuals, you know, in the carceral setting, to be in a place where your entire job is to care for people who are dying and suffering, that how life transforming that could be to be in a place where you can openly take care of someone else and be there for them and show that compassion. And I just imagine that has to be, was transformative for you, but also for anyone else who gets trained in that program.
Yeah. I didn't just adjust my entire, you know, my entire experience with culture within the prison system. Like I totally had to rewire like how my mind thinks, because it's just, all I explained to you was like just one aspect of what happens in there. You know, there's a multidisciplinary team that is very active, close, and dedicated to providing, you know, a resource, you know, of end-of-life palliative care. And so the correctional staff members, the correctional healthcare folks are all on the same page with a central focus of providing that compassionate care to the residents and the patients that live in that space. And everybody's equally committed to like providing that care. And so like to see this for the first time in the prison system where I spend the majority of my life, you know, it's mind altering. You know, I had to reflect quite a bit on like what I was observing. You know, I've never, you know, experienced, you know, from a collective group of correctional folks, you know, humanizing, you know, incarcerated people. And they were good at it. And they were authentic. They were sincere. And the patients could feel it. The people outside of the hospice, meaning like other, you know, places in the institution, could come into the hospice and feel that space of normalization that was, you know, woven into the culture and fabrics of the end-of-life palliative care unit. So I want to be very descriptive. You know, the place is called the Robert Evans Alexander Hospice. It's the only licensed hospice in the California prison system. And a lot of people in the prison system are very aware of this place's existence, but there's a lot of people that don't have a clue that it exists, and they've been working in the prison system for quite some time. So, you know, for someone that spent the majority of his life, myself, referring to me, I had no idea this place existed. And once I had an opportunity to step foot in there and had the, you know, and had the, you know, experience of being in there, you know, like it's still a special place. No matter where I go in life, I will always gravitate back to that place of normalization and love. So, yes.
Wow. That's so beautiful, but so powerful to hear that story and the difference it made in your life, but that now you are going on and you're making such a difference for other people. It's kind of the ripple effect in a way of this kind of work.
Yeah, when Nancy Alexander was still alive, in 2018, we had a hospice, a garden dedication ceremony to Dr. Pick. The garden was named after him. I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but we had an entire space behind the hospice dedicated to, you know, a garden that was created. And when the garden was complete, you know, it's complete with a gazebo and like, you know, an awning that protects the patients with a fountain present and some benches that just resembles, you know, like a real garden in the community, something beautiful. And Nancy Alexander was giving, you know, a presentation to a lot of dignitaries and folks from the Department of Corrections, a lot of media folks. And she wanted everybody to know that the people that worked in there were ambassadors of peace. And I truly felt that way. Like, you know, being in this role, you know, being there for so long, and even the years after that I've left, I feel like I'm still a representative of the people and the culture there. And she was right. We are ambassadors of peace, you know?
Mm. Wow. That's so beautiful. And from what I understand, there is quite an aging population in prisons throughout our country now. And that I would imagine that most prisons don't have a hospice or are lacking this type of care.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll speak to that a little bit. So the prison population is aging in a lot of states. I mean, the elderly prison population, excuse me, in a lot of states, you know, prison populations in some states are declining, but those who are elderly are really increasing at very rapid numbers. And I told someone recently when I have been in the California medical facility to help facilitate the classes we're training, you know, you walk down the halls and in the media, you think of people in the prison as being these buff young guys, and it is not look like that at all. It is men there who have canes, wheelchairs, walkers, you know, hobbling along the hallway. And the national estimate that we use and that I always often find quoted is that by 2030, it's estimated that 1/3 of incarcerated people in the U.S. will be elderly. And in prison, elderly is really considered to be 55 and older, because prison actually, for various reasons, physiologically ages people more quickly. So it's a tremendous population. Our prisons, both the physical facilities and sort of the attitude of corrections historically, was not developed to serve an aging population yet. That's largely what we're facing.
And it sounds to me, Fernando, like in your work, you're training incarcerated people to take care of their fellow incarcerated people within the prison system. And yes. I'm curious to know if even the training has an effect on other people who are incarcerated who aren't part of the hospice training or palliative care training, and even on the staff, if you see changes and transformation that happens throughout the population.
Right. You know, with any sort of like paradigms or any sort of like, you know, whenever we're confronted, you know, in the prison system with necessary change or like immediate change that needs to happen, I can see and feel, you know, how folks are willing to evolve, you know. And what I mean by that is like, people are very well aware of their neighbors getting older. You know, the neighbor that they once had that was vibrant and they were able to run around and, you know, do pull-ups, you know, endlessly on the bars, and now they need help getting out of bed. You know, now they need a wheelchair. You know, now they need help getting transferred from a toilet to a wheelchair and vice versa. You know, so there's a lot of unofficial caregiving that happens within the system out of necessity. You know, there's just not enough official caregivers, you know, that could be assigned and trained, you know, to help every elderly, you know, incarcerated person that needs, you know, some sort of assistance, right? So there's a lot of unofficial caregiving that happens within the system, you know, and there's folks like myself that work in the hospice that help to provide like very basic information to help, you know, like a healthier, younger resident help someone that, you know, that they're living on the same bunk bed with, you know, to read mail to, you know, someone that's now visually impaired, you know, to help cut someone's hair or trim their toenails or their fingernails now that they can't do it, or to, you know, help them get to a visit, you know, to help them get off of a bunk and go use the bathroom. Like, these things are happening within the system because of how rapidly the population is aging. You know, and like Lisa mentioned, there's various reasons why, you know, the population is aging. But yes, this unofficial and official caregiving happens and is happening out of necessity. People are evolving to meet the needs of the folks that are in their community. And it's really sad to see people aging to the point where they pass away in prison. You know, we're literally punishing people to death in our state and, you know, across the rest of the nation. So this is something that's actively happening, and that requires, you know, a lot of unofficial care. Yeah, makes it.
And it's very sad to me to think of someone with a terminal illness. Actually, I mean, I imagine some in our country die without receiving care, without receiving palliative or hospice care, and end up dying and suffering where they are, and there isn't a facility there. And maybe they do have other people step up who offer some care to them, but they're missing the palliative aspect and that they could be receiving if there were a program within the prison.
Yeah, so it would definitely enrich and enhance the overall quality of life to have, you know, a body of people present that could provide this sort of care to the folks that need it. You know, palliative care, you know, of course, like the clear definition is like helping folks that don't have the means to help themselves anymore. You know, they just don't have the capacity to, you know, do the basic functions, you know, that everybody has the capacity to do, you know, and eventually they'll need hospice care as time goes on. So yes, in California medical facility, they do this quite well. And I just, yeah, you're right. Putting in perspective how many people or how many institutions throughout the country or even our state that don't have that resource, you know, truly, you know, affects the population in a negative way. So not just the population, but the people that work there, because, you know, the correctional folks aren't really trained to be able to provide that service. So that's unfair to them as well, you know, because, they're worthy of having, you know, that educational, that education provided to them so they can provide a better service. So,
yeah, and there's sort of a moral injury that happens when we see someone else suffering, but we don't have the means or the ability of helping them. And so that's a burden on everyone throughout the system.
I agree. And there's a reason why, there's many reasons why, you know, I will state it statistically quick. You know, correctional staff members, correctional officers have a mortality rate of the age of 58. Mm. You know, and I can only imagine how this could be one of the many moral injuries that they encounter observing, you know, somebody that they cannot help that needs it, you know, and, you know, that's harmful. There's harmful effects involved with what happens to a correctional staff member that observes that, that didn't receive that training to help somebody that they're observing that's going to suffer. So, yes.
Yeah. I'm for either one of you to answer, when you do, as part of your program, are you going into prison facilities now and training incarcerated people with palliative care skills? That's what you're offering. Are you finding people eager to receive the training, like volunteering, who want the training?
Yeah, we are. We spent the last kind of year and a half, 2 years, really developing a curriculum around this and working with a pastor who's led the program at California Medical Facility, Keith Knopf, who Fernando referred to, and a physician there who's led that program for many years, to really kind of institutionalize the training and the beauty of what has been created at the CMF Prison Hospice so that we could take it to other prisons. And so we just this week, we're completing our pilot training a group of men at the California Medical Facility prison. Half of them are already prison, work in the prison as end-of-life caregivers, and half of them will. And we are piloting with them this with them so we can get their feedback. And we're going to graduate a group of, Fernando, I think it's either 12 or 13, right, on Thursday. So we're very excited about this. And we will be going into a women's prison, Central California Women's Facility, this fall. There is currently an informal group of women there called Comfort Care Workers who have banded together and get some support from an outside hospice, Heinz Hospice, to learn to provide care to those who are aging and dying. But there's no formal palliative care or hospice care program. And so our training there will be part of a broader effort within, you know, the correctional healthcare system in California to really develop a palliative and hospice care program for women in the state of California. And then our plan is to be able to take this program to other other prisons in California. And, you know, eventually our dream would be for this to really be a national model and for us to be able to share the curriculum we've developed, the work that we're doing with other states. We're already in conversation with several other states who are really interested in the work. So I think this is kind of just the beginning of what's possible. And you've referenced a few times how few of these programs do exist. I mean, nationwide, there's not any really good estimates, but of about 1,800 prisons nationwide, there's fewer than 100 of these programs, and fewer yet use this model of trained incarcerated peers as caregivers that we think is really central to this work, and having those people work alongside the correctional healthcare team, the physicians, the nurses, the chaplains, the social workers. So very exciting time.
Oh, that is very exciting. I'm so glad to hear that you're creating a curriculum that could be transferred and spread to other institutions, because I think that's so very important.
Yeah, I think, Lisa, you said it great. Like, one of our plans is to centralize it so other people have access to it, and, you know, we can support them, you know, around like implementing this in their system. So that's one of the goals. So,
and then just clarify for me, do you utilize volunteers from the community who come in to the institution to do some of the training?
Fernandez,
yes.
It's your team.
Yes, this is one of the goals. This is one of the targeted goals that we have, is to get people as we can get interested into like volunteering and to begin, you know, like partnering with us to train as many folks as we can, as in as many states as we can, you know. And it, to me, it makes complete sense, you know, to like recruit from the local areas in which we intend to like go into the institutions that we're going to train folks in, because, you know, who knows the community better than the people that live in it, right? You know, and I feel like there could be some degree of resistance if there's too many people from California going into other places and like, you know, introducing them to these, you know, modules and these, you know, this facilitation that they can, you know, potentially not relate to us, you know, on that level. So I really feel like it's important for folks that or in different states to get interested, to look at our website, contact us, you know, and see, you know, if they'd be a good fit, you know, to want to do some facilitating and some training with us. So yeah, that's like one of the messages that we wanted to put out there and send to people to, you know, to definitely take a look at our site, learn a little bit more about us, and make an inquiry about possibly getting involved. So
are you looking for people who already have hospice training, like who work for hospice nurses or social workers, chaplains, or death doulas who have training? Or could it be someone who's maybe never been trained in hospice before, but has an interest and wants to step forward?
Yeah, I would even say like students too, medical students, nursing students, people that have experience as doulas and, people in hospice. So yes, people with no experience. It's always good to like meet folks that potentially could offer, you know, a service that will help people. I'll give an example of what that means. Like, we always have a need to like, for someone that has zero experience, there's a program called Compassionate Release, in which patients are released into the community. We always need somebody that would be willing to meet some of these folks, you know, some of these patients when they're released into whatever facility they're going to or home, to even meet with them, you know, to be social with them, to, introduce a sense of community to them. And, those are folks that we're looking for as well, you know, and they mm-hmm. don't have to have an experience other than wanting to relate to another human being in a compassionate and loving way, you know, like there's other ways for them to get involved with us, you know, even if they don't have mm-hmm. experience, that could be one of them. So
yeah, that's a great example. And I would think of for people who receive a compassionate release, which is great, so that they can get care that they need and be in a place where they can receive care, but they've also been released from probably what has been home to them for years, and even the people who may seem like their family and community. And so no wonder they definitely need connections on the outside and people who care about them, who will come right in and be there for them to have someone to relate to and talk to and know that someone cares about them.
Right. And it's extremely important. Most people that are incarcerated feel like they've totally been rejected from the community. that they don't have a sense of community beyond the walls. And it is, you know, really restorative, a restorative practice to have this done. You know, there's so much healing with connection. So, yeah, we feel like it's important. And, you know, people that want to volunteer that have no experience, you know, they have great, they can have great potential and like what they can offer to another human being to help them heal and feel welcome. So
it seems to me like it's really good for the surrounding community as well to have this type of hospice program, because I would think that there's so much separation between the surrounding community and, as you said, the walls of the prison, that it's really healthy for the surrounding community to be aware of the need for a program like this and the needs of the people who are incarcerated, who are aging and getting terminal diagnoses, and to know that there's a place for them to step up and offer some help and just make stronger connections between the inside and the outside, I guess.
Well, there's that large invisible wall as well. You know, there's a lot of people in the community that really don't want any sort of association with death. They don't want any connection to like end of life because, well, it's pretty taboo. It's like very unpleasant to talk about or be connected with, you know. So there could be someone listening right now that, you know, it's like starting to understand the need to like acknowledging every aspect of life, and the end of life is truly important to acknowledge, you know, and that avenue in itself, like, is important to acknowledge and be a part of and understand, like, it's inevitable, right? And how do we want this inevitability to look like? You know, like, what is our connection to that? What is our relationship to that? So I feel like that's another one as well, you know, and it's an additional one. It's a huge, you know, invisible wall, like, and I feel like it's worth acknowledging. So
yeah, that's so true. So glad that you brought that up. And Joanne, I was wondering if someone is out there listening is thinking, oh gosh, I know that we could use a program like this in our community if they live near a prison. What steps does someone have to take in order to create a program like this, or to even get started, or where do they begin?
It's a program like this does take a lot of work, but there's always, to like Fernanda said, there's always things people can do. And I would encourage them first and foremost to visit our website, to get in contact with us, to learn more about both our work in California, and then let us have conversations with them so they can start researching what's going on in their own states. And like Fernanda said, we're always looking for people to get involved as this work gets more known and we begin speaking with people in more states. I think the movement will grow in strength, but it does take a lot of work. It takes partnering with you know, local hospice organizations, with academic centers, with departments of correction, but there's always things people can move forward. And, you know, even if it's as simply as gathering a group together to watch Prison Terminal to start educating, and we do panel discussions, we try to get together fairly large groups, and then our team will show it virtually or the Prison Terminal movie and have conversations about this work and about how people can get more involved. We are now active on Instagram and Facebook, so you can follow us. And we're just, you know, eager to speak with people, whatever walk of life they're in, who are really interested in moving this work forward.
And I noticed you do have resources on a lot of resources on the website that could be very helpful, as you said, as a place to begin for anyone who's interested. And maybe we each have to start wherever we are in our community and see what resources are there or who else is interested and brainstorm how we might be able to make a difference.
Yes. And it does, you have to be really patient working within the carceral system and know that, you know, learn to celebrate little victories. This work, our work at Humane, was really the brainchild of a woman named Sandra Fish. And she is an actor by background. She's not, you know, didn't have a hospice background, but had done prison work in hospices. I mean, excuse me, in prisons, both in New York and in California. And this idea came from her asking an attorney one day who was defending people on death row, how do incarcerated people die, specifically this determination to move this work forward, which eventually led to the origins of Humane Prison Hospice Work Project and the work that we do today. So really, you have to celebrate these small victories and know that you're in this for the long game, but there's a lot that can be done.
Yeah, that's so encouraging to hear. And I wanted to ask you, Fernando, if someone out there is thinking maybe they are aware of a program and wondering if they could get involved, but they might have some fears or trepidation about stepping foot inside the walls of a prison. Could you describe, like, what is it like if someone from the outside comes into the prison, and what advice do you have for people, or how could you help them overcome any fears or hesitancy they have?
Just want to provide some clarity really quick. I love being a guide to the great unknown. And for a lot of people in the community, the carceral system in prison is a great unknown, right? It's just things that we hear about, but really have no connection to the realities of what happened. The first thing I want to let people know that have no experience in coming to the system is that regardless of where people live or how they look, they're people. And that's regardless if they wear a correctional officer's uniform, if they're wearing the uniform of an incarcerated person, whether they're wearing the scrubs of a correctional healthcare professional, they're people, right? They're people first, and they're defined second by, what they've done, what they haven't done, So most of the people that we come in contact with are extremely grateful that they have an opportunity to be redefined, spaces in which they could be redefined, right? And so, like, getting involved with a lot of this programming and projects, people that sign up are want to get involved. You want to be able to have space to redefine themselves, right? To be known for something completely different, for being present to offer a service to the community, to be helpful, so that's something I would like people to know. A lot of the folks that we come in contact with are typically eager to, like, communicate with us, the carceral folks, because they're so used to, one of the many reasons why they're so willing to be vocal and, like, outgoing with us is they're accustomed to having other people tell their stories for them. Mm-hmm. Their entire history is being told on paper by the worst things that they've ever done. The narratives behind their character, has been completely framed by everything bad. So when they have opportunities to speak, it has to do with their unique qualities as opposed to, like, the worst thing that they've ever done. So that's what I would like for people to know. And that could sound like a generalization, but I just want people to reflect on, like, what we're doing. We're going in spaces and we're working with folks that want to get involved in end-of-life palliative care. And I've yet to meet anybody where their hearts aren't in the right place. They just need skill development to be able to deploy that, desire to want to do well, so that's where we come in. So the actual physical structure, the physical layout of a prison could be intimidating for somebody to see for the first time. But once they come in contact with the human aspect of it from every angle, they'll begin to, like, feel relatable to the folks they're coming in contact with because they can see their humanity. So that's what I'd like people to know.
Thank you for that. That's such good reassurance for people. And I think I really got the sense from Prison Terminal when Edgar Behrens, like, lived within the walls of the prison to do his filming, that it was just another sort of home in a way. And that the message I got through Edgar and that film is to be comfortable, that there's nothing to fear, and that we can be comfortable, as you said, with the people and their desires to learn and to be involved. And even the setting itself doesn't have to be that intimidating. We get used to that. We get used to what this type of home looks like for people and what it requires to be there.
Yeah. Well said.
So if someone is listening, especially if you live in a community where there might be a program starting or there's an opportunity to do some work within the prison walls and you're interested, take advantage of it. Don't let fear hold you back, because it sounds like it's a life-changing experience for those who come in from the outside and get involved.
Yeah.
Someone from the outside, it's been totally a life-changing experience for me. You know, 8 years ago, I never thought about what life was like for incarcerated people, what people were like who were incarcerated. And after hearing so many stories, even in the limited time that I actually go in, has been beautiful and transformational. And these people behind walls are just people, just like all of us. And we've all made mistakes, you know, maybe their mistakes were bigger, but hearing people's stories and seeing the transformation that can come within the human spirit, even in prison, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And certainly, Fernando, your story alone is a testament to the transformation there. You know, I found like working in any setting with hospice patients and people at the end of life, it's transformative, because when you're with someone who's facing the very end of their life and their perspective actually is in looking back at life, oftentimes, and reviewing life, it just reminds you of how fleeting life is in the first place, and to not waste a moment of life that you have.
I use the analogy all the time about like working in these spaces with folks that are passing away, how they're like holding a mirror up to me, you know, like holding a mirror up to me, and they're confronting me with my humanity, like my place in the world. How do I want my end to look? How do I want my legacy to look? You know, how do I want to be remembered when my time comes? You know, like, how do I want to be remembered in this world? And like all those things I'm being confronted with by looking at somebody. We maybe look completely different, have completely different experiences, but their humanity that I'm confronted with every day is like holding a mirror up to me, like I just said, you know, and it helped me to become a better human being, right? Because I answered those questions after being asked them, you know, and I wanted to clearly define like what I was going to do for the rest of my day, for the rest of my week, for the rest of my month. And I want to solidify and personify all the things that I wanted to be in my everyday walk, you know? So like, I was very cognizant of that. I was very mindful and completely self-reflected on like what I was doing throughout the course of my day, how I think, how I speak, how I interact with people, you know, all those things I'm very mindful of, because I had this mirror held up to me every day, you know? And I felt like it's a wonderful experience to be able to, you know, allow, you know, our fellow citizens of our community and life, you know, hold a mirror up to us just to help us clearly define like who we are, where we want to go, and how we want to be defined when the time comes for us to pass away. So keep the legacy in mind, you know, the dash. I have a friend named Jose that used to always talk about the dash, you know, and you have, you know, on your headstone, you have your birth date and your death date, but the dash is like who you are. That's how you're defined. And I'm mindful of that. You know, I definitely want to keep that at the forefront of my mind when I wake up in the morning. So
That's really beautiful. And there's nothing like hospice and palliative care work to keep that in the forefront of your mind at all times, because you get reminders every single day on the job of, wait, this is how it is, and this is the perspective I need to have about life.
Yeah.
I often meet healthcare providers these days who are feeling burned out in their work and within our U.S. healthcare system. And I feel like a lot of those people might really benefit if they were to just to volunteer even a few times and become part perhaps of what you're doing, to see it from a completely different angle. And it seems to me that could be really renewing for people who are feeling jaded and exhausted by the whole thing. If they came in and saw how much difference you can make, as you were saying, Fernando, with the small things that you do for another person that can make a big difference for them.
Right. So, wow. Yeah. You know, I was just, I hope my friend doesn't mind me talking a little bit about this, but my friend recently published or republished, you know, something that I, you know, I've already been peered in. And she was talking about the importance of somebody bringing her a whipped cream latte, you know, and how much that meant to her, like in her time of despair, you know, like the treatments that she was, you know, experiencing, you know, in the hospital, you know, for her cancer. And to have this nurse just come out of nowhere with this giant, you know, foam latte with this whipped cream on top, you know, and how meaningful it was, you know, to receive that. You know, there was no monetary exchange there. There was nothing other than a gift. You know, like she didn't request, hey, can you go get this for me? No, it was just a gift out of the kindness of someone's heart that made someone's day. That gave someone enough like motivation and joy to like make it from one treatment to the next, you know, with a smile on their face. That's priceless.
Mm.
It is so priceless for someone to receive that unexpected gift. One that came from the heart, obviously, right? And those are the examples of like the difference that people could, differences people can make in this world. You know, like I think like when you mentioned the word jaded, I feel like so many of us, you know, we get so jaded, especially in our society, especially when people are working in industry that's like strictly for profit, you know, and they're working with folks in need, you know, these are the simple things that we can do, you know, to brighten someone's day, to make them feel loved. You know, like to help someone. I've experienced many times. I had an ALS patient, I won't say his name, that used to smile so big when I used to comb his hair.
Mm.
You know, because it was me, because we had a connection and I was just combing his hair and he was so happy. You know, he couldn't speak, but he could make some sounds and you can just clearly his smile was just so big, you know, and just cracking jokes at the same time, you know, just made his day. You know, like we were human in that moment in time. We made that connection, like somebody was laughing, you know, and you know, those are examples that people, you know, can make themselves available for that can truly change, you know, how someone's day is, you know,
mm-hmm.
Making a card. I believe in 2020 during the height of the pandemic, I'll take complete credit for this. I'm fine with it. But we created a program in which it was just very grassroots, in which we had a lot of people. We appealed to a lot of people in the community through social media. You know, we did this with third parties and partners to send in letters and cards into our hospice patients because, one, we couldn't even see them face to face. We had masks and shields on. It became so impersonal. They weren't allowed visitors because of, you know, COVID-19. And so I was thinking of ways to like make, you know, help our community feel loved, to help them feel that sense of compassion. And to see all these letters pouring in, all these cards coming in from not just our country, but from many different countries, put a smile on our patient's face. I'll never forget, there was this little, this I think it was, he was like 7 or 8 years old. I think his name was Ryan. He's from Canada. And he sent this card with a rainbow on it and a cloud. And he said, in Canada, we put these on the window as like a community in solidarity, you know, about like what we are part of, what we need to do to shelter in place. So he drew one of these by hand and sent it to one of our patients. And it just brightened his day. You know, the examples of like, of that, you know, like truly make a difference. So I hope that kind of covered the question that you were asking.
Yeah, I think it's just so beautiful to be reminded that humanity is simple, really. Like it's connecting, like you said, connecting in even the simplest, most authentic ways that we can. That's really beautiful. Well, I wanted to ask one more thing. Are there also within your program, do you address grief? Because I could imagine that grief is a huge issue within the incarcerated population and the staff and everyone involved. And when someone does die, that grief is an issue to be addressed. And how do you deal with that?
We have an entire module dedicated to grief and loss. It's extensive. It's in an entire you know, like pamphlet, module book. So yes, we cover it quite extensively, not just from the academic standpoint. We have conversations around like the experiences that our participants have around grief and loss, you know, and we provide them the space to be able to share some of their personal experiences while working, you know, in a palliative care, you know, area and just in their housing units and their personal lives. So yes, we cover this, and it's really rewarding to make this available to folks that, like I mentioned, you know, typically don't have the space to tell their own stories. That's really rewarding. And I feel like this is very important work. And when it comes to grief and loss, you know, like this is something that I feel like was really rewarding to our facilitators as well, to be able to make that connection with the incarcerated folks, you know, our trainees, and they shared their testimonies with us extensively, how rewarding it was for them to make this connection with people that are incarcerated around, you know, the topic of grief and loss. So.
And that work is ongoing work to be done. You know, we're hoping to be able to continue to go in, you know, quarterly, monthly, depending on the need, but to provide, if those spaces don't exist for the caregivers who are doing this work, to provide that just open space for them to talk and to process all of the grief that they're going through, doing the work, and, you know, so much grief among incarcerated people about what they're missing on the outside in their families, with those that they love. So very important piece of all of things.
Well, I wanted to make sure we direct people back to the website, humanehospiceproject.org, but I wanted, is that right?
Prison Hospice Project.org.
Thank you. Yes. Excellent. Thanks for, yeah. Okay. And I wanted to ask if there are ways, like for people who maybe live too far away to be part of the training or hands-on in the program you're offering, are there other ways some of us can support? Do you need donations? What other kind of work can be done from afar that might support what you're doing?
We definitely need donations. we're a small nonprofit, but we don't currently get any correctional money from the correction system, and we really rely on individual donors, family foundations, other groups who are interested in supporting our work, and that's what keeps us alive and being able to continue to do this work in the world. So yes, absolutely. And like I said before, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and reach out if you're interested. We're just really, you know, want to be part of just kind of a catalyst of getting this to be a real movement that people think about and people care about in our society more broadly.
So it's on social media. It's also humaneprisonhospiceproject.org on social media.
Yes, I believe that's correct. I'm not very active, Fernando. You know better than me. I follow Instagram. I'm not the best one to.
Yeah, I don't have social media. So, like, yes, our communications director definitely has more information on that. But
can't find us, reach out to us.
Well, I'll put links. I'll get those probably from Laura and put those on the show notes for this episode for people to follow. But another good thing, for people could share this interview. They could share the prison terminal film, as you suggested, like host a film night and discussion and talk about prison terminal. And then also be sure to go to humaneprisonhospiceproject.org and look at all the resources. And so you were mentioning you have a curriculum that's coming out very soon that will be available.
Yeah, our curriculum, it won't be posted on the website or anywhere, but we really want, as we take this work to other states, to make sure that the training that we've created is kind of delivered in a way that both works with the different culture in different states, but also with the integrity with which it was created. So we're kind of, right now, we've just received some grant funding to sort of plan for dissemination and what that will look like. But we want to make sure that, you know, kind of we're involved at least in helping to shape that and hand it off to other people, because this is such important work and so much has gone into preparing to where we are today. So, yes.
Yeah. So anyone interested should just contact you through the website to learn more about that.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with me and sharing with me. And is there anything else that we didn't cover that that you'd like to mention or any last words?
Oh, I would like to thank you for your time and, you know, reaching out to us and helping us to get our message out there. This is definitely a community building, you know, project, you know, community enhancing one. So, you know, to get this message out is very important. And we really thank you. I would like to thank you for allowing us to send that message, you know, through your platform. So it's very, very kind of you. Thanks.
You're so welcome. And it's my honor. And I'm excited to send this out and have a lot of people learn about your program. So thank you both once again for joining me.
Thank you so much, Karen. It really is, like Fernando said, just wonderful to be able to get the word of this work out in the world and just to hopefully help shape people's thinking in a different way around these groups that are incarcerated. So thank you.
You're very welcome. I hope you found that conversation with Lisa and Fernando interesting. I was really fascinated in particular to hear Fernando's story and to see how his life has been entirely transformed and what amazing work he's doing now to help others who are incarcerated, teaching palliative care to some of the inmates so that they can care for their cellmates. It's incredible. And I feel like this is a very powerful movement, very important. It has to do with justice and dignity and how we love and care for one another. So I'd love to see a big swell of support for the Humane Prison Hospice Project, but also particularly to help this movement spread to other communities, because certainly we need prison hospices everywhere in every single prison in our country. So if there happens to be a prison where you live or you know someone who has any connections, if you can spread the word, share this episode, tell people about the Humane Prison Hospice Project. Let's all do whatever we can to spread the word and to help this movement grow. So if you enjoy content like this, I hope you will share it with other people and share a specific episode or just tell them about the podcast. Also, make sure to subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen. And again, if you're willing, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support to find ways you can make a small financial contribution that will help keep this show on the air. And always, I appreciate your emails and messages through Twitter, which is not Twitter anymore, through X and Instagram and Facebook. And thanks for all of you who stay in touch with me and let me know what you're doing and how you're enjoying the podcast. That means everything to me. So I'll be back next week with another interview. Until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life may bring you next, and love each and every moment that you have the opportunity to be here on this planet. Bye-bye.